Blog Talk Radio.
Hello.
Hello.
My Two Cents on Wrestling, hosted by Jay Williamson and Al Miller, starts right now.
Okay, welcome to a special edition of My Two Cents on Wrestling. Martez, are we going here?
Can you guys hear
Martez,
me?
Martez, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I apologize. My microphone wasn't on.
No, we're good. We're good.
Okay, I don't know what's playing in the
special edition of My Two Cents on Wrestling.
Got that echo again.
I did that.
So we're all here.
We had See It on the Line. We had See It on the Line. I'm going to call him live on air again, okay?
Okay, let me do the intro real quick. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a special... What?
He's not here yet. He's not here yet. I'm going to call him off here.
No, I...
Yeah, we got a special guest.
Okay, here. I got to do the intro and start talking here for a minute. Do your thing. Welcome to a special edition of My Two Cents on Wrestling. This is a little short 30-minute episode because we have a special guest scheduled to come in today. I am your host, Jed Williamson, as always with my co-host, Al Miller. And we just wrapped up our 50th episode of My Two Cents on Wrestling, where we watched the second half of ECW's November to Remember 95. And we had a special guest that was only announced this morning by our executive producer. So it was a pleasure to talk with Big Con, formerly Connor of the Ascension. But right now we are trying to get Psycho Sid on the phone because we – promised we scheduled him as an interview last week, but according to his agent, he was sick. So yes, Martez.
Yeah, he's with us. He's with us right now.
Okay, so with no further ado, ladies and gentlemen, former WWF champion, former WCW champion, I believe. I hope I didn't just misquote that. As well as one of the big names of the entire Attitude Era and Monday Night Wars. Mr. Psycho Sid. Sid, are you with us?
I am now.
I'm sorry?
Yes, I am. I said, yes, I am.
Oh, I'm so sorry, sir. I apologize for that. Welcome to the show, sir, and it is an honor to have you on with us today.
Well, thanks for calling me.
Sure is.
No, absolutely, sir. I'm so sorry that you were feeling sick last week. I hope you're feeling better. And I just can't wait to start picking at your brain about your career.
All right, well, go ahead.
Well, first question is, I thought I heard somewhere that you have a son that's in the business.
No.
Am I wrong?
What happened?
No.
Yeah, you're wrong. What happened was, here's one strike against you already, okay? All right, so no.
My apologies, sir.
I know because you don't do your homework. All right, so this is what happened. My son helped me. I filmed a documentary called The Promotion.
Yeah.
That I put in the film cover. Can I finish?
Oh, I'm sorry. That wasn't me, sir.
Okay. So I did a documentary about small town wrestling called The Promotion that I put in film festivals, and I'm going to put in one this year, too. And he stood in for me, and he played the character, or stood in as the character, as Lord Humongous, which I had done that character earlier in my career. So, and then I did Lord Humongous in I think, in the documentary as well. I don't know if we got that part in. We did so many takes. But anyway, just to let people, if they see that, they'll say, hey, that was Sig at one time. So he just stood in. I needed Scott Hall did a few cameos for me in that documentary. A couple wrestlers out of Memphis, one named Poker Face. And but that's what that was about.
Oh, okay. So if anybody listening has any time on their hands, go check out the Promotion documentary. Sounds like it's got a lot of faces that you'd be familiar with, and talk about the history of Sid's beginnings in the career, business. And I do apologize if I do seem unprepared, sir. I do kind of we kind of wing it.
You're not the only.
Yeah, we kind of wing it on the show here.
Right. No problem.
I wanted to
ask a lot. And I'm just guessing when I've answered this question so many times for so many other people, I'm guessing that you guys just haven't heard the answer.
It's true. It's very true, sir. I don't have a whole lot of time to listen to a whole bunch of other podcasts and interviews for the most part. I actually spend so much time watching the product that I like to try to keep kayfabe still a little alive. I don't try to pry into the personal lives of the wrestlers because it's the mystique that the business brings that makes it so fun to watch. But when you get an opportunity like this to speak with somebody of your caliber, that I couldn't pass it up.
All right.
So everybody who knows anything about your career knows that when you first got your big breaks, it was NWCW or Al, you'll know better than me. Was it still NWA?
At that time, I believe it was.
So I believe you got your big break in the NWA. I'm sorry, go ahead.
You know, it was just being bought out by Ted Turner, and it was in the transition of being – it had already been named WCW. And NWA was owned by the Crockett's, and they were phasing them out. So really I wasn't in the NWA. It was WCW when I came into it.
Okay.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Because you were such a dominating presence when you first hit the scene, because there weren't too many guys your size at that time. I mean, there was always big guys, obviously, but you knocking on that 7-foot mark and just the build that you had that presence that you were destined to be one of the top guys. And your in-ring work spoke for itself. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. No, this is the thing is, I think what you're looking for is this. You know, I was not much taller than everyone, a little bit taller than a few and shorter than a few. But this is the thing is, I tried to play myself to be 10 foot tall with all the, you know, all the little things I did. And I won't go into all of it. Like when I walk to the ring, find the camera, you know, get into these people's living rooms because that's the people who are watching, not the few hundred people or 1,000 people, even if it sold out, 10,000 people. You know, it's millions at home watching. So that's what I tried to do. When I got through with, you know, what I was trying to achieve, and I think I did it, was just make people believe in me. And I think that's why, I think that's what sort of you're looking for.
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, because you did, you had that great posture that made you seem like you were even taller than maybe you were. That it just seemed like you came off as just like, I mean, I know there's always that handful of guys that was as tall as you because, you know, you worked with me, Mark Callis, back in the day, and he was your size and whatnot. But
yeah, me and Mark were about the same height, and Kevin Nash was a little taller than some of us. Now, I'm not saying it wasn't tall, 6'7", 6'9", but this is the thing is I can move really good for a big guy. And so, again,
no doubt.
I was real explosive. And so I think, again, when you see my matches, they were all pretty tight. There wasn't anything people would guess to go, man, is that real or not real? You know, the guys I worked with, even in the house shows, I remember Scott Hall was one of the great. And there was a lot of guys that were great about this. But, you know, I would say, okay, you know, I'm going to bend you over in the first kick, tighten up a little bit because I'm going to kick you really hard. And everybody's going to hear that first kick. Then after that, it's going to be a little easier. You know what I mean? So when people heard that, and that's something I was always taught too, is that you're not playing to the person at the front row. You're playing to the person at the top of the arena. So I wanted that person
right
up there to feel like they were there as well. And then, you know, I got the luxury of being around some of the greatest minds in the whole business from the time I started till even today. So I took advantage of that, and I picked, you know, apart some of the things people would do and give me, and then I'd take what I thought would work, and I put it in there, and see things worked out.
Absolutely. Your matches were always very intense, and when you were in WCW, you were going under Sid Vicious. When you had your first run in WWF, was it a major change for you to try to be Sid Justice for that time period? I mean, did you always know that they were going to bring you back to Sid Vicious, or was that like just spur of the moment thing, or what was that?
Well, that was WWF. They didn't like using other people's names, and whatever the reason, if you haven't heard, you should have said, this might be strike three against you. But no, he tried to use somebody else's name or something he could trademark himself. I looked at it like this. I don't care what the name is. You know, like, I didn't care what color my boots were. If people are worried about what my name was or what color my boots are, I'm in the wrong business. People better remember from me, my face, my interview, what I do to the next person. So I didn't worry about the name, okay? Names are stupid. That's it.
No, I agree. I agree with you, sir. I was just talking about being a baby face versus the heel that you normally were. Was that hard for you to pull off?
No, it wasn't. The thing is, I really wasn't a baby face that long. And really, I never changed. And that's what they don't want you to do. You don't change your character just as a baby face. I'll be honest with you, I never enjoyed being a baby face.
I kind of got that feeling, sir, because it always seemed like you had more fun, or you were able to tap into more intensity as a heel than you did that brief time that you were a babyface.
Well, the thing is, heel or babyface, I get cheered about as much as anyone ever did. I think I got cheered a lot more as a heel than maybe as I did as a babyface. So, and again, I enjoyed that heel thing because there's a lot of, as a heel too, guys, we get to dictate the match, and it's really up to us, you know, for us, what happens out there. And so I enjoy being, you know, leading things. And I've always been a leader, and I just felt more comfortable as a heel.
Okay. Fair enough. Gal, do you have a question for Sid?
How did you like your time over in New Japan?
You know what? I had a good time over there, but man, I'll be honest with you. It's a tough way to make a dollar. I was treated really well. Joe Diago, I think, has just recently died in the last year. He was my agent over there. They brought me over 2 or 3 weeks early to work in the dojos and learn the style. I was actually brought over there to take Bruiser Brody's place. So they brought me over and showed me, you know, just nights and nights and nights and weeks of tape on Bruiser Brody. And the whole idea when I got there was Inoki was trying to get himself, you know, sort of a shot in the arm. So we did an angle where I was main event every night, and the very first of the tour, he was the first match. And by the end of the tour, he worked himself up to the main event. And then, I put him over. So but up to that, I was beating people up, beating up the audience, just like Bruce Brody did, running through the place like King Kong and Godzilla. It was a lot of fun, but I fought to death over there. I was beat up when I came home. I was skinny. It was just, again, a tough way to make a dollar. I'd like to go back just one time just to see what it was like. You know what I mean? Because when I was there, everything was moving so fast, you know?
Right.
So for the general wrestling fans that may not know, you know, they watch the New Japan product and they don't understand the difference between the Japan way and the U.S. way. Can you describe some of the differences between the styles?
Well, it's one is a lot more solid, and I don't mind that part. But the thing is this, say for instance, and I'm sure it hasn't changed. I just done the Lord Humongous character for like a year, and I hadn't been in a match more than 5 minutes my whole life, and or maybe much more than 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes, or I don't know. Anyway, I was at the Sumo Palace the first night. They had the Russian Olympic team there, and they're suplexing everybody on their head. So they asked me to come up. They gave me a sheet of paper, and I was like, "What is this?" They said, "I said, is this the whole match?" They said, "No, this is the finish." And I gave it back to him. I said, guys, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not going to be able to do that, you know. And I was, you know. It's a lot more physical. Again, I say this again, I don't mind being physical. That part is just the finishes are so long over there. So many false finishes and stuff like that. Now, the cool thing about it was because the language barrier, there wasn't – any rhyme or reason to a lot of things, you know, you pick somebody, you watch the matches, you see someone that maybe it's one old timer. Yeah, I guess he had his gimmick was his head was made like steel. So if you just put his head into the turnbuckle, you know, people go woo. And that's something else. The fans do not react over there. There's hardly any reaction, you know, when compared to the U.S. And I guess you guys have heard this. If y'all haven't heard this, it's strike four against you. In Japan, for the most part, people go there because they can't get a job in the U.S. Have you heard that?
I have.
That people go to Mexico territories in Japan and whatnot when they can't find work here. Yeah, I've heard that.
There you go.
Also, I just wanted to touch on...
Sorry, Al, I apologize.
No, go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say that I heard that the fans are so quiet over there because their culture, they are like the respective of the match that's going on. And then once the finish takes place, then they respond.
Right. Or there's a spot in there, like I just said, if there's like everybody's got their own little deal over there. Like if, I'm sure Muda, when he does the spray, they go crazy. But this one old timer, I remember talking about if you wanted to get the people to respond, just do something to his head, they'd go, woo, you know. So, but that's the only thing. And then the food is so expensive, man. I starved to death over there. I was getting so skinny. I figured how to get free food. I'd go to the lobby and make peanut butter and banana sandwiches, and the promoters would see me there, and they saw how much weight I lost. Then they'd take me out and eat. Where I could get something to eat.
Well,
that's great.
Probably
I think that would be
something to address at the beginning of the run, but I guess.
I don't think I'd survive over in Japan either.
No, man.
No.
I'll never forget, like, the very first time we were on the road, I guess in a tour bus, we stopped at some little friggin' restaurant and went in and everybody ordered the same thing, and I don't know what I can only hear what they're saying. They're all ordering chicken, curry, and rice. When they got back to me, it was like a speck of rice about the size of a half a dollar, and then just one piece of chicken and some curry. And I said, "Damn!" I said, "Where is the chicken at?" And what? I said, "Where is the meat? Don't act like you don't hear me." You know, and everybody was freaking out. The agents were like, "Be quiet!" I went, "No, I'm not being quiet. Where's the goddamn meat, man?" So that didn't matter. I tell you, I did see. I shouldn't say this, but the one thing I did see over there scared the shit out of me. Now you got to realize, I'm only 1 year in the business, right? And so you hear so many rumors about the Japanese mafia, where they'll just, you know, stab you in the hallway or whatever. And so I don't remember the town or anything, but Bob Orton was working with Master Saito. And they wanted to do the finish where Saito would give him the clothesline. And Bob Orton said, "No, just tell him to roll me up." And that little Hattori guy, the agent and referee, said, "No, Bob, don't get lazy. Work hard." And I don't know what happened in the match. I didn't watch it. When they got back, Hattori told Bob, said, "Come over. They want to talk to you in the dressing room." And our dressing room was open. And when they walked through the door, they slammed his head in the doorway and they beat the shit out of him. And the next day they met him at a hotel, gave him his money, and sent him home. And I said, "Man, I don't want any part of that."
Wow.
I would either.
So I ate my two pieces of chicken, a couple bites of rice, and I was happy. Now, I'll tell you one thing I did. I guess the people saw me losing so much weight, they felt sorry for me. There was one place right across from the Keel Plaza where I stayed at. It was like a sort of equivalent to a Bonanza or, you know, Golden Corral. And so I would get the hamburger steak and rice instead of baked, because they'd have baked potato. And, of course, the guy couldn't speak English. I couldn't speak Japanese. But he got feeling sorry for me. So what he did, he gave me one hamburger steak and a half and all the rice I could eat. And, man, I did not like rice.
Lord.
I ate rice by the pound.
what you would really call a happy meal for you. You were happy to have a good meal.
Yeah, I was, dude.
Great story, Seth.
Absolutely. I'm so sorry, Sid. I'm going to have strike five against me here in a minute because
I'm
kind of blanking.
Keep it up.
I had one more question. How did you like your time at CCW under Lord Humongous?
You know what, guys? That was a lot of fun. And several reasons for it. One, and I'm sure we all are. I don't think people were as much as I was. One thing, when I went to Continental, I didn't know there were other territories other than Memphis. And what we saw on TV, the NWA at the time and WWF, I didn't know there was Continental. I knew a little bit about, I did know a little bit about World Class. But I didn't know there was Continental and the Florida territories and all that, or Charlotte. And so when I got down there, it was nice to see all the people I saw in Memphis before. Tony Anthony, Danny Davis, Dutch Mantel,
right.
Robert Fuller, you know, all the people, you know. And then I saw the Sheep Herders, which I'd done a little bit of a gig in Memphis with them one time. So it was cool to see them. So one was that. The other one, I didn't know the downsides of the business. I didn't know there was jealousy. Until one time in Gaddison, Alabama. But there was a lot of things that were so good about it. It was all brand new. We weren't making any money, but I was making enough to pay my bills there in Montgomery and Birmingham, well, Birmingham for the most part, and send money home to pay my bills at home with my wife and kids. And that's all I was able to do in the beginning like that. But it didn't matter about making money. It was just being on the road, you know, and, man, that was so much fun. Seeing everything for the first time, experiencing everything for the first time, making those trips, there was never a minute of dread. You know, it was just fun, fun, fun.
I've always heard the road stories are the best.
Yeah, man, those little small territories are so much fun. There's no pressure. I'm sure there were for some people. I just didn't know where it was. And I never felt pressure even in the big territories, guys. I made pressure for other people, and everybody knows that. I never looked at a booking sheet. I never knew who I was working with. But when I walked in, I could tell you who it was, because most of the time, they looked like they were the most nervous person in the dressing room. Everybody knew I didn't look at a booking sheet, and I didn't care who I was working with, and I didn't care what the finish was, and volunteered to put people over when I didn't have to, because it was just a better thing to do for the Hill when you couldn't get other people to do business. So I think I was easy to work with. Again, it was just, I had Continental too. For the most part, I was working with Danny Day, who's one of the greatest workers in the business. A lot of people don't know that, but man, he was a smaller version of Ricky Steamboat or another version of Steve Kern. They just could go like machines. And so I got to learn from the best. Again, in Continental, right place, right time, Robert Fuller was the booker. Made really good friends with him. He took really good care of me. The owner of the territory, David Woods, he even came to WrestleMania when I worked with Hogan just to see me. So, again, I had great people around me.
When you were there front row,
I was about to say a little bit of note, information is that my co-host Al here was actually there too at that WrestleMania.
Front row.
Oh, really?
Yes. It was a great match. It was a great entertaining match.
Well, I appreciate it.
I really thought it was.
Well
guys,
Sid,
I
know that. Sorry, go ahead.
You go ahead.
I apologize, sir. I was just going to say that I know that we had a limited time with you today because I was told we had about a half an hour and we're getting a little close to that. So I wanted to ask you real quick, and I don't know if you want to talk about this or not, but the match where in WCW when you broke your leg coming off of the rope, is that something that you're willing to talk about?
Well, this is the thing is, I've talked about it a million times, but this is what happened, if you're wanting to know. I just was asked to do that. I wasn't comfortable with it. And unfortunately, what happened, happened.
Wow.
Okay. No problem.
Wow.
I figured as much. I just didn't know if there was anything more to it or not, so I just figured I'd ask. So thank you very much.
The only thing that's more to it, I had a dumbass that really don't know anything about the wrestling business thought that one stupid spot like that would change the goddamn tide of a sinking territory, which that wasn't going to happen. And I was the canary in a fucking cage, in the coal mine, until the canary died. So that's what happened. I was the best canary to try to save the territory.
Yeah, absolutely. That time period was the major downfall of WCW. That's when they were spiraling out of control. And we've heard
that
from
Jim
so
Hurt?
Many different people.
Was
no, that
under
was under Vince Russo. That was under Russo, wasn't
that was,
it?
That was the downside of Vince Russo. And then Vince Russo was already taken out. And they hired some idiot named Johnny Laurinaitis, who did have no idea how to run a territory or how to book or anything. His thought of making it to the next level was coming off the top rope with a fucking high knee, which made no sense at all. It really helped, All right, guys. Well, I got to get going and listen to the music. I appreciate y'all having me on the show. And next time,
thank you very much for giving us the time, sir. It's been an honor. And I do apologize for not being one of the best interviewers you've ever had or anything. So I do apologize. And you have yourself a great night, sir.
Shut up for a second. Shut
yes, sir.
Second. I'm going to tell you, I turned down the announcer on WWE Corey do his podcast to do this podcast, and look what I got myself into. With you,
I do. Like I said, I do apologize, sir.
Yeah, well, kiss my ass. Just kidding.
Thank you for coming.
All right, guys,
okay.
I appreciate
you
having me on. I wish it could have been
better. Thank you very much,
sir. It was still pretty fun.
Okay. I appreciate
it. Good night, guys.
You have a great night.
Good
Bye-bye.
Night.
Oh, okay. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was Psycho Sid. I was a little more nervous during that one, obviously, because this is a legend that we're talking to with so many decades in the business and everything. So once again, I apologize to Sid for not being prepared. I guess I wing it a little too much. So my apologies again and again. And I appreciate that he took his time to come on our show. His stories were spectacular, as expected, and I'm a little speechless, honestly, because let's face it, I just shit the bed. Al, you carried that interview. Yes, you did.
Yeah,
you carried that on that interview.
No, yeah, I appreciate the credit, but you're the ones that, you know, get the people, and you're the one that carries the conversation. I understand that.
Well, Marquez gets the people.
But
it was
fun having him on. Hopefully we can have him on in the future with a little longer interview.
Right. That's another reason why I was so nervous, because I knew that he kind of had a reputation of being a little stiff in his conversations. So I was like, I didn't really know what he's going to say next. And granted, he said just kidding, but when he said kiss my ass, I was like, oh God, I can't believe he just told me to kiss my ass on my own show. But
we overlooked that.
Okay. No,
that's
he said just kidding. So I was just like,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly.
I should have prepared better for it. There's no argument there. I just should have prepared better. But thank you guys for tuning in for this special episode of My Two Cents on Wrestling.
You're
this
still
is
a
technically
great
episode
host.
50. I appreciate it, but I got a long way to improve. So thank you, Martez, for hooking us up with Sid and Al. Always a pleasure to talk wrestling with you. And thank you. You kind of saved my ass on that one with your two questions, because I was out. All I had left was the leg question, and that didn't even go nowhere.
No problem. Martez, thank you.
So, see you guys next week for Battle Royal at the Royal Albert Hall from 1991. It'd be funny if Sid's on that show. We'll see you next week.
Take care, guys.
Welcome everyone to Impact SmackDown Live!